Well, a warm welcome to you all as we begin our last session before Easter. And this evening we're introducing a new topic, that is that of wisdom. Wisdom in the Old Testament is a type of writing, a genre, a category, like history or law or prophecy. Now this evening we're looking in particular at the books of Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. Next time, our first session after Easter, at Psalms. And while I'm classifying all these as wisdom literature, we should recognise that a lot of these books, particularly Psalms, doesn't really constitute wisdom. And indeed, we do find wisdom in other parts of the Old Testament. Now, the wisdom literature in the Bible isn't unique. That is, it wasn't written in a vacuum. You remember when we spoke about Genesis in September, we recognised that there were other ancient Near Eastern texts in a similar genre, the Gilgamesh epic, the Enuma Elish, for example. That is, other stories about creation coming out of Babylon, Assyria, and Egypt. What Genesis gives us is the Israelite account of how the world was created in reaction or in response to other accounts. And similarly, wisdom literature was common in the world of the ancient Near East, more like philosophy as against history, prophecy, or history. It's a sustained reflection on life and the meaning of life. There are different types of wisdom literature. Proverbial wisdom literature, not surprisingly. Proverbs, a good example. For example, a wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son brings grief to his mother. Ill-gotten treasures have no lasting value, but righteousness delivers from death. These are short statements that are intended to encapsulate some truth about the world. Then there's speculative wisdom literature, which is more like philosophy, ruminating on the nature of life. Here, Ecclesiastes is a good example. The book starts, meaningless, meaningless, or vanity of vanities, all is vanity, says the teacher, to those of us who are a bit older and more used to the AV. And then there's narrative wisdom literature, literature that tells a story, of which Job is the classic example. And then fourth, lyrical wisdom literature, rather closer to poetry, the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs. Now, what is wisdom? What is wisdom? A simple definition is the ability to make good and godly choices. It's not so much about intelligence or IQ, about winning Brain of Britain or University Challenge, but it's about spiritual perception. That is, knowing the value of things. The opposite of the wise man in Scripture is not the unintelligent or the uneducated, it's the fool. The fool is someone who lives his or her life without reference to God and to wisdom, and simply pays no attention to how the world is made. Famously, Psalm 14:1 says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." Now, it's easy to miss the fact that the Bible recognizes that wisdom exists in nations and societies outside Israel. 1 Kings 4 writes this, "God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight, and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the people of the East, and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Heman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame spread to all the surrounding nations." So Solomon is presented as somebody who was wiser than all the wise men of the East, Ethan, Heman, Kalkol, and Dada, being wise men from other cultures. All the nations came to Solomon to hear his wisdom. And while the Queen of Sheba visited Solomon partly because of the reports of his fabulous wealth that had reached her, it was also because of his wisdom. Particular types of literature in the Old Testament are associated with certain people. For example, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible with Moses, the Psalms with David, who wrote about 50% of them, and wisdom, in particular Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, with Solomon. Although we have to recognize that a good deal of these books have elements of ghost writing and the addition of other parts. There's a very famous passage at the beginning of 2 Chronicles where God appears to Solomon at the beginning of his reign and asks Solomon for whatever he wants God to give him. And Solomon answers wisdom and knowledge so that he'll be able to govern this great people of God's. And this really pleases God. And because Solomon hasn't asked for wealth, possessions, honour, for the death of his enemies or for long life, God chooses to shower Solomon also with wealth, possessions, and honour. What we have was written towards the end of the monarchy in the 7th century BC and around the time of the exile in the 6th century. Wisdom literature grows in popularity during the exile and in the centuries that follow. Jeremiah 18 gives voice to three types of literature, where Jeremiah writes, "They said, come, let's make plans against Jeremiah. For the teaching of the law by the priest will not cease, nor will counsel from the wise, nor the word from the prophets. So come, let's attack him with our tongues and pay no attention to anything he says." So we need to note, we need to distinguish the teaching of the law by the priest, the word from the prophets, and counsel from the wise, which is wisdom. So where does wisdom come from? Partly from old Hebrew proverbs, from the very earliest days. And then again, when Israel was in Egypt, from a connection with the Egyptian culture through Joseph. And that began the wisdom tradition within Israel. And then later on, the association between Israelite kings and other nations impacted the tradition in Israel. It's quite interesting that some of the Israelite wisdom literature, particularly in Proverbs, is the same as Babylonian and Egyptian writings. For example, in Proverbs 22, where you get 30 sayings of the wise, 13 out of those 30 seem to have simply been to have lifted from Egypt. And although the scholars debate about that, it's basically the same stuff. So some of the Bible, horror of horrors, was actually written by Egyptian wise men. What about the social setting? Well, there were schools of wisdom. Again, in Proverbs, have I not written 30 sayings for you, sayings of counsel and knowledge, teaching you to be honest and to speak the truth, so that you bring back truthful reports to those whom you serve. So the wisdom teacher was writing Proverbs to pass on to the young. Something similar in Ecclesiastes. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. The schools of wisdom were often connected to the royal court, and the royal court was a key context for wisdom. But there's a big difference between the wisdom of the Old Testament and the wisdom of other Near Eastern traditions. Because in the Old Testament, it comes not simply through experience, but through revelation. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that's the distinctive approach in Israel. That's where you start. And of course, fear isn't terror. Fear is respect, attentiveness, focus. Looking at what we have from Babylon and Egypt shows that typically the literature is concerned with the common stuff of life. And we get that too in the biblical proverbs: teachability, sobriety, wise speech, kindness, trust, divine help, magnanimity, friendship. There's quite a lot that is, you might call, worldly wisdom. But there's much too that's characterized by high principles. Although the biblical material, as distinct from what you get from Egypt and Babylon, moves at a consistently higher level of informed faith. But all of the literature is wrestling with the common problems facing humanity: suffering, the meaning of existence, and so on. What is clear is that not only in the time of Solomon, but for 1,000 years before him, so Solomon was at the beginning of the first millennium BC, the second millennium before that, the Israel of the day was anything but a cultural backwater. This expression, the fear of God, to which Ecclesiastes moves at its end, is the starting point of Proverbs. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. To shun evil is understanding, written also in Job. Secular philosophy tends to measure everything by man. And of course we see that today. It comes to doubt whether wisdom can be found at all. What the Old Testament does is to turn the world upside down and puts it the right way up, with God at the head and God's wisdom being the creative and ordering principle that runs through every part, with man disciplined and taught by God's wisdom, finding life and fulfillment in God's perfect will. So all of that really by way of introduction. Let's start with Job. Job stands alone among the books of the Old Testament. Who wrote it? We don't know. It might have been written between about 700 and 500 BC. Job is an Edomite, that is, he dwells east of the Dead Sea, and he's a very rich man. He's rich not so much in terms of cash or stock exchange investments, but rather of flocks and of herds. And he spends part of the year in the city, and for the other part of the year he's on the move with his cattle. He belongs to the days before you get an organized priesthood and religion. And indeed he lives in a place where these things were not thought to be needed. He reminds us very much of Abraham, in fact. So what you get at the beginning of the book is a great debate, after the beginning of the book, what you get through the book is a great debate between Job and his friends. And the main issue is this: if God is just and good, why do innocent people suffer? Why do you get casual victims of war and terrorism? Why a child dying of cancer? As a man, Job is really good. We mustn't miss that. He's about the best that any man could hope to be. Yet he is overwhelmed by calamity. He loses his possessions. He loses his family. And you then get this grim, prolonged suffering, which, yes, really shakes Job's faith to the core. So how does the book start? Well, you get a conversation, rather a charming conversation in one sense, between God and Satan in the heavenly courts. And God, if you like, throws down the gauntlet to Satan. He said, "Have you not seen my servant Job? What a wonderfully pious, good, upright man is he?" And Satan responds to God that Job is only like that because of his great wealth. If you take that away, then you will see what sort of man he is. So, if you like, Satan is challenging God. And that's what happens, that Job's material possessions are taken from him. He loses everything, but initially he trusts God. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I will depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Do you remember the chorus we've just sung? May the name of the Lord be praised. And then Satan says, well, that's all very well, but why not start to attack his body? And Job is afflicted by boils, really very, very uncomfortable. And all his family, particularly his wife, turn on him. And Job starts to rail at God. And his three friends, the so-called comforters, come and sit by him. And a lot can be said about them. I mean, basically, theologically, they get things totally wrong. But they do spend 7 days just sitting in silence, being with Job, because they see how great his suffering is. But what happens is, one by one, there is the three of them, and then a fourth younger man joins them, is that, yes, we can see your suffering. It must be some sin that you have committed. And Job resolutely rejects that. And of course, the problem with the book is this, that Job and his three friends are ignorant of the larger issue, the challenge of Satan that's related in the prologue. And they have no assurance of a future life. For them, death is the end. And so the context of Job's comforters, is that justice has to be seen to be done in this life. And there was an orthodox theology that you find represented in the comforters, that prosperity, material prosperity, was a reward for living well, and material calamity was God's judgment on sin. And you get that sort of view, don't you, in the New Testament? Do you remember John 9, where Jesus gives sight to the man born blind? And the question is, who sinned that he was born blind? Was it this man or was it his parents? To which the answer is, of course, it was neither. There isn't necessarily an answer in the terms that we are looking for. So if Job is suffering, he must be wicked. Job knows this to be untrue. And the argument goes back and forth, neither side shifting their position, until at the end of chapter 37, you get a complete impasse. And then God speaks. I don't know if any of you have read the suggested reading for today, the first two chapters, and then chapters 38 to 42. God speaks out of the whirlwind. Significantly, God doesn't answer Job's questions. But in seeing God and hearing directly from God, God is satisfied. Job is satisfied, and we come to understand that if the comforter's theology had been too narrow, then Job's own concept of God had been too small. So, what does Job give us? What does the book give us? Well, an inner critique of easy answers. There's no easy link to be drawn between sin and suffering. There are many things that we can't understand. And indeed, the book leaves us with a lot unsettled. And we have to recognize that it's only in the New Testament that we begin to approach an answer to the problem. Only when we look at Christ on the cross do we see the suffering of the only really innocent man who has ever lived. And we see also a God who cares so much for us that he is prepared to take on his own shoulders the whole burden of human sin and suffering. The book of Job is very up to date. And even today, men and women who are suffering, and there may be some of us in this church this evening, find that Job speaks to their need as does no other book in the Bible. So what are we to take away from Job personally? Well, I think it's a good thing, it's a proper thing to bring our questions and complaints before God. Because alongside his questioning, Job has a longing for God. Our memory verse from chapter 19. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes. I am not another. How my heart yearns within me. What a wonderful statement of Job's faith. Second, I think the answer to Job's questions isn't an argument that's won or lost. It's an epiphany. It's the appearance of God himself. And I think that's quite an interesting observation when we come to think of arguments, discussions. It might have been in our 20s, if we can remember that far ago, long ago. With friends over a late night cup of coffee about things like suffering. And of course, the thing about those arguments, and indeed arguments that one might have with people today, there's a problem if the person who is raising the issue has a closed mindset as to how the issue is going to be resolved. And I think it's like that with Job's comforters. If, on the other hand, you have an open mind, and even if one might not be a believer, one is prepared to admit to the possibility of the existence of God and the possibility of meaning in a world which may appear not to have any, then it's in that context that enlightenment might appear. And it's because of God's appearance to Job that Job's attitude is completely transformed. And so I say on the slide that his experience is transformed not by cold argument, but by the reality of the living God. Yeah.
You said that the concept of afterlife was in the thought processes of the three friends of Job, and yet Job says,
yeah, I was thinking. Can I come back to that?
It was
the comforters who had this. The comforters had this closed view that this life was all. That's what I was intending to say. I'm sorry. If I did, I'm sorry. That's what I intended to say. So that's Job. Let's move on then to Proverbs, which is probably the earliest of the books of wisdom. Compiled over a period of time, its earliest writings dating from around Solomon's reign, but not reaching its final form for another 400 or 500 years. Proverbs is a book of wise sayings, not simply an anthology, but it's a textbook. It has a very practical purpose. It's intending to educate young men, and also wives in right living by repeating wise thoughts. What you get in Proverbs is wisdom distilled into short, sharp phrases, dramatic contrasts, unforgettable scenes from life. It presents us not just with a sort of get rich quick or get successful quick philosophy, but it sets out what is right and what is wrong. Because wisdom in Proverbs is based on reverence for God and obedience to his laws. The essence of all true human wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And so what Proverbs does is to apply the principles of divine teaching to the whole of life, to relationships, home, work, justice, decisions, attitudes, reactions. Everything one does, everything one says, everything one thinks. God has taught us what is best for his human creatures, and that is proved by experience. Proverbs is divided into eight main sections. First of all, chapters 1 to 9, a general introduction on wisdom, then six collections of sayings, and then finally, in chapter 31, a poem on the perfect wife. One probably ought to have something on the perfect husband. When I got engaged to my lovely wife, Annie, one of our friends, Lydia, actually, who we met a couple of weeks ago in Suffolk, wrote to me and said, congratulations on acquiring the perfect Proverbs 31 wife. And Annie had a look at Proverbs 31 and decided she didn't want to be a Proverbs 31 wife, because it's quite hard work. It's rather fun being a Proverbs 31 husband, because all you do is sit in the gate and people come and say lovely things to you. But anyway, there it is. So the essence of Proverbs may well have been a collection of Proverbs written by Solomon, but not all of them were written by Solomon. We have reference to the saying of Agur, son of Jeke, and the sayings of King Lemuel. The sayings in Proverbs are often directed from the old to the young, with advice on how to live well. Once you get beyond the first nine chapters, the general introduction on wisdom, Proverbs is best digested by taking a few sayings at a time. Sometimes it can be helpful to take them by themes. We're going to mention a few of these in a minute. And if you do weigh Proverbs up by its themes, then you can get a good idea of its general teaching on a particular topic. We have to remember that what you get in Proverbs is necessarily generalizations. That is, Proverbs is stating what is generally, but not what is invariably true. The writer isn't denying that there are exceptions. For example, Proverbs says that if you live by God's standards, you'll prosper in the world. Yes, that's generally the truth, but it's not an unqualified promise, because after all, Job, and indeed the life of Christ, show the other side of the coin. So what sort of themes do we find in Proverbs? I'll rattle through a few of these. Living in harmony with divine order, learning to live according to the pattern of wisdom, how to live to this pattern in even the small details of life, avoiding violence, avoiding promiscuity, avoiding laziness. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? And so on. The importance of striving for discipline, for integrity, for prudence and patience. The advice of the royal court. Proverbs 25 writes this: do not exalt yourself in the king's presence. Do not claim a place among his great men. It is better for him to say to you, come up here, than for him to humiliate you before his nobles. You can remember, can't you, the reflection in the New Testament, better to seat yourself in the lowest place and be invited to come up higher. And then a particular one is the call of wisdom and folly. And there's a particular connection in Proverbs in the context of sexual ethics, that the fool is somebody who is open to being seduced easily by a married woman. The woman who comes out sees the fool, says, come, let's drink deeply of love till morning, let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He took his purse filled with money and will not be home till full moon. And then by contrast, does not wisdom call out? Does not understanding raise her voice? At the highest point along the way where the paths meet, she takes her stand. Beside the gate leading into the city, at the entrance, she cries aloud, to you, O people, I call out. I raise my voice to all mankind. You who are simple, gain prudence. You who are foolish, set your hearts on it. And it's Yahweh who gives true wisdom. For the Lord gives wisdom, from his mouth come knowledge and understanding. And then Proverbs 3, which I love, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to him, and he will make your paths straight. We get resonances of that in the Psalms. And pride. Proverbs writes about pride, how destructive pride is. So values of Proverbs: discipline, integrity, prudence, hard work, obedience, listening to your elders, and generosity. We've said under interpretation that Proverbs are general truths. They're not particular guarantees. So you can't take particular verses out of context. And Proverbs can contradict each other. There's a lovely one in Proverbs 26, 4 to 5. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him. And then next verse, answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own ways, in his own eyes. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him. You'll be drawn into being like him if you have anything to do with his what he wants to talk about. And yet, next verse, answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes. If you don't contradict him, then of course he'll think he's right. What do you make of that? Often the deeper instinct or wisdom lies in knowing when a particular proverb applies. Biblical wisdom is not just about memorizing scripture, but rather about having the spiritual instinct to know when particular scriptures apply. I think that's very true, isn't it? And as we go on in the Christian life, as we learn more scripture, not just committing verses to memory, but that is a very good thing. Remember, that's how Jesus often used scripture, particularly in the face of temptation. But actually going even deeper than that, understanding the deep meaning of scriptural truth. So that's a little bit about Proverbs. What about Ecclesiastes? Well, the book was written later than Proverbs, perhaps between about 250 and 200 BC. It's very similar to early Egyptian writings. And Ecclesiastes might seem quite strange to us. It can seem disjointed because its thoughts and sayings and observations on life seem quite disconnected. But the theme, the overall theme of Ecclesiastes is very modern, and you can pick up resonances in any number of contemporary novels and plays. The author of Ecclesiastes is the teacher. Koheleth means teacher in Hebrew, and when that's translated into Greek, that gives us the title Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes is attributed to Solomon, who of course was the epitome of wisdom, better qualified to pronounce on life, having tasted it to the full. Sadly, apart from power, fame and riches, women in particular, and of course it was his foreign wives with their foreign gods who led Solomon into idolatry. But while attributed to Solomon, it's more likely to have been ghost written. So how does Ecclesiastes proceed? Well, the author just looks at life around him and draws the logical conclusions. Life, as he calls it, under the sun. Life as man sees it. The author has no preconceptions. Life as it's lived by man without God is futile, meaningless, purposeless, and empty. It's a bleak picture. And there's a kind of circular pattern to history. It goes round in circles. There's nothing new. If you add up the profit and loss of human life, you're better off dead. Pretty depressing. Life is unfair. Work is pointless. Pleasure fails to satisfy. Good living, wise thinking rendered futile by death. Be realistic, says Ecclesiastes. If life without God is the whole story, see it for what it is. Don't pretend. Don't bury your hand. That's the truth about life. But having said that, that of course is not the whole picture. Because God, who created human beings, never intended those human beings, you and me, to leave him out of the picture. And if we will allow God to enter into our life, then God will inject joy and purpose into every aspect of living, from food and work to home and marriage. And God intended man to find ultimate satisfaction, not in life, but in him. One of my favourite psalms, anticipating a month's time, is Psalm 63. In Psalm 63, verse 4, says, your loving kindness, that is your love, is better than life itself. That's the message, if you like, of Ecclesiastes. Yes, the wise man, like the fool, dies, but wisdom is still good and right. And the just and the wicked together will be judged by God. Enjoy life, not as an Epicurean, that's an ancient Greek philosopher who lived life on the basis of eat, drink, for tomorrow we die, but rather because as a man or a woman of God, you can depend on God for life and for enjoyment. Remember God while you are young, fear him and keep his commandments. Ecclesiastes, you remember I was looking at the four types of wisdom literature. Ecclesiastes is speculative rather than proverbial wisdom. It's the voice of one person reflecting on life. And although God seems silent, Ecclesiastes writes this: he has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. That rather strikes, doesn't it, or resonates with the idea of the God-shaped blank. There is a blank in our hearts that God has made, which won't be satisfied until we discover God in Christ. There is an inherent pessimism about Ecclesiastes. Death hangs over everything. All share a common destiny, writes the author. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As with the good, so with the sinful. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. So what's the response? Well, it is to take delight in the simple life. This is what I have observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. Within Ecclesiastes, you get a self-critique of wisdom literature. Wisdom literature itself is not the answer to everything. Solomon is made to say this: I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. All this I tested by wisdom, and I said, I am determined to be wise, but this was beyond me. Whatever exists is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? So what Ecclesiastes is doing is picking up both wisdom literature outside Israel that has no reference to God, and also within Israel, how wisdom literature is misused. Jeremiah writes this: how can you say we are wise, for we have the law of the Lord, when actually the lying pen of the scribes has handled it falsely? The wise will be put to shame. They will be dismayed and trapped. Since they have rejected the word of the Lord, what kind of wisdom do they have? What matters, yes, wisdom is important, but what matters is how you live your life, not how you speak or write. There are few easy answers in life. Yes, Ecclesiastes criticizes wisdom, but wisdom is still preferable to folly. It's important to fear God. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. So, although wisdom does have its limits, it is good. And it's important to enjoy what God has given. Ecclesiastes is a book for people who've got more questions than answers. We can still fear God and thank God, even if we don't understand him. Even people with questions can believe. The opposite of faith is not doubt, but unbelief. Faith and doubt can coexist. That's important, isn't it, to remember as believers. We shouldn't pretend to understand God. Questions are natural within the life of faith. So to that extent, there's a tie-up, I think, between Job and Ecclesiastes. The question is, what do you do? Or the issue is, what do you do with these questions? So fourth, let's turn to the Song of Songs, which variously is called the Song of Solomon, that's how I've spoken of it before this evening, and the Song of Songs. And possibly it's one of the most surprising books to find in the Bible. I think it's the most wonderful book. I've recently read a commentary by Charlie Cleverly, who's the vicar of St Aldate's in Oxford, which is, it's actually more than a commentary, because it really opens up the meaning of the Song and Songs, Song of Songs, and says something, I think, deeply significant about the love of God. So what is the book? Well, it's a series of lyric poems on the theme of love between a man and a woman. The setting is pastoral, lots of images from the countryside, the time is spring, and the Song of Songs is full of the passion and the delight of human love. There are some verses from chapter 2 that are often chosen to be the reading at a marriage. I'm taking a service of blessing of the marriage of my nephew and his fiancée in June, and they've chosen this passage that I will delight to preach from. The Song of Songs is difficult to understand, so there's been all sorts of interpretation down the ages. Both Jewish commentators and Christian scholars have seen the poems as allegories of God's love for Israel, of Christ's love for his bride, the church. You can't get authority for that directly from the poems. What they're doing is describing in quite intimate detail the feelings of the man and the woman for each other, their longings to be together. And what's happening throughout the dialogue, because I think there's more dialogue, in fact, than narrative, is that sex and marriage are put in their proper God-given perspective. And so I think, conclusion, the Song of Songs is an allegory, both of God's love for Israel and for the church, and a literal story about married life. It's a historical story with two layers of meaning. So at one level, we learn about love, marriage, and sex, and on another level, we see God's overwhelming love for his people. And so as we read the book, we remember, first, that we're loved by God, and second, we commit ourselves to understanding life and sex and marriage from his point of view. So picking up the five major themes. The first is love. What happens in the Song of Songs is that the relationship develops as romance develops, as specifically the romance between Solomon and his bride, whoever she was, developed. And this intense, because it really is intense, power of love really captures the hearts, the minds and bodies of the two lovers. And the point that the book is making is that love is not a casual thing. It's something that goes to the very heart of one's being. We're not to manipulate people into loving us. And in a relationship, the growth of love should be allowed to proceed by stages. So that's love. Then commitment. Because love needs more than language, more than words to protect it. It does mean complete commitment of one to the other. And although romance keeps a marriage interesting, commitment to each other, just as in the marriage service, you know, will you take this man to be your wife? Will you take this woman? Will you take this man to be your husband? Will you take this woman to be your wife? And the answer is, of course, I will. Commitment. I remember the second marriage I did last year at Haysborough. The groom was so excited by the prospect of the lovely Alex that I hadn't finished asking my question. He came out with, I will! Which is really good, actually, because everybody roared with laughter, and it sort of made everybody relax. But it's important to remember that love, married love, and indeed all sorts of love between people, is a commitment. Then sex. God's desire is that sex should be motivated by love and commitment, not by lust. Sex is for mutual pleasure, not for selfish enjoyment. Beauty. Just wonderful verses about how each praises the beauty that they see in the other. And the language is very evocative of the spontaneity and the mystery of love. And the beauty is not just physical beauty. It's beauty of personality and morality. And then because the author of the Song of Songs is very realistic, life is not always plain sailing. This is obviously what I will say to a couple as I prepare them for marriage. There will be problems. There will be times of loneliness, indifference and isolation. There will be times, or the, maybe not will, there may be times when love seems to grow cold, when there are barriers. And of course the point about that is not to depress the couple, but just to make them realistic and make them understand that when problems do arise, first of all, they're not the first couple in the world to have problems, but second, you can get through them by this commitment and by this thinking of the other through communication. That's often the biggest thing, that that you talk and romance will be refreshed and commitment renewed. Take care of problems while they're still small. So that's been a very quick canter through all of Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Songs. Next time we meet on the 8th of May, we'll be looking at the Book of Psalms. And what we've seen this evening is that wisdom literature, particularly Israelite wisdom literature, seen through the eyes of the New Testament, is for all people and for all time. Job addresses perhaps the number one question which people who object to the claims of the Christian faith ask, that is, how can a God of love allow evil and suffering? Job gives you at least if not a complete answer, some pointers to the question. And of course, we as Christians living this side of the cross know that it's ultimately to the cross that you need to go to understand God's answer. And then Proverbs. I remember when in the early 80s I was working as a solicitor in the city of London as a new Christian. The British Institute of Management adopted Proverbs. I mean the BIM, not notably a Christian organisation, but recognised that in Proverbs you had this distilled divine wisdom for, in particular, good business management. And that's quite interesting, speaks for itself. And Ecclesiastes, although expressing its truths in the context of God and God's purposes for the world, resonates with so much that you get in modern thinking and contemporary literature. And of course, the way its distinctive note is that it refers everything back to God, and so does find meaning in life. And there will be people who come along and say Christianity is anti-sex, and all you need to do there, well, is it all you need to do, but you could start by pointing them to the Song of Songs and explore what it has to offer in teaching about married love. Quite difficult to find a book to recommend this evening. I've put Derek Kidner's quite old now, but I think very good commentary on Ecclesiastes. And then I've got our verse from Psalm 119 for next time. I have hidden your word in my heart. That I might not sin against you. And then after our first few 5 minutes or so of quick questions, the question I'm posing this evening to think about is this. Which of these four books, Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes and the Song of Songs, and some you may know better than others, seems to appeal to you most, and why? What difference might a closest study of that book make to your life? So I think that's all I'm going to say